Thank you very much. I bought my own liquidity, but it was going to be supplied. All right. Thank you. Now I've got an abundance. Thank you very much, Romeo, for the introduction, and to Credit Suisse for the opportunity to join this conference in Asia. Asia remains one of those parts of the world where prospects for growth are exciting, where people with good reason expect the future to be better than the past. For the past 6 months, of course, the attention of the world has been wrapped on the old world, Europe, where some have come to fear that the best actually was in the past. And we in the Reserve Bank of Australia have taken a very close interest in, as I'm sure have all of you, in what's been happening in Europe. So what I'd like to do is begin with a few remarks about that, talk a little bit about the global scene, then come to some specifically Australian things, and then come back to some points about the Asian region at the end. We have, as I say, taken a great interest in the events in Europe. In part, that is at an intellectual or analytical level, the complexity and the magnitude of the problems that have been thrown up in Europe is quite striking. And this will be a fertile area of study, I think, for people in economics and, for that matter, other disciplines for many years to come. Of course, the adoption of the euro was not solely, maybe not even mostly, an economic decision. But it did nonetheless have economic consequences. It's true that in a number of very important respects, the euro's first decade was a great success. But there were important structural stresses underneath, and those have become much more visible over the past couple of years, as we all know. Now the euro's future depends on whether the commitment of the Europeans to the single currency extends to a willingness to build some of the economic substructure that really has to be the foundation for a single currency zone. That will entail both fiscal and supply-side reforms, and that's a very big task. Of course, it's very hard to build the foundations when the house has already been erected on the site, but in fact that's what Europe has to do over the period ahead. I think the evidence is that our European colleagues fully grasp the importance of that response, and they're going to great lengths to make it as we speak. Some progress has been made, and I think that should be recognised in other parts of the world. Some progress has been made over recent months. But there's a long way to go yet, and during that long journey, there will be numerous episodes of heightened anxiety, any one of which could potentially erupt into a more serious crisis if one or more of the major actors makes a significant mistake. And I think that is the world in which we are going to live for some years. Stepping back from the purely analytical or intellectual frame, in practice, what have recent events in Europe meant for us in my country and in the broader world? Well, I think we could say at present that the euro area has been in recession for several months. A number of countries in Europe, of course, have been in a steep contraction for longer than that, but I'm talking about the eurozone as a whole. It's clearly been in some sort of downturn for some months now. That recession is expected by most official forecasters, both in Europe and outside of Europe, to be reasonably mild. But the truth is, of course, that with cyclical episodes like this, one can never be sure. So how do we think about the effects of that on our own economy? There are a number of potential channels that we could articulate. I want to cover just a few very quickly. In Australia's case, naturally we would think of the direct trade link. Well, that's not very big. In fact, our trade exposures to this region in Asia are a multiple of our exposure to Europe. And so we don't anticipate a major impact via our slower exports to Europe, even though that no doubt will occur. By far, the bigger trade impact would come indirectly through the effect of slower European growth on Asia itself, and therefore on us because of our links with Asia. Now, on that, it's pretty clear that growth in Asia slowed in 2011, and no doubt towards the end of the year, slower growth in Europe was contributing to that. The difficulty is that a number of other factors have also been at work around Asia, at least as we see it. There was the Japanese tsunami about a year ago. The effects of that on production chains and on the data had probably not quite finished when the Thai floods occurred, which has then initiated another round of disruption to the very tightly knit production chain around the Asian region. Those effects are probably still having some impact on the data. So really, I suppose, to assess the impact of Europe, it's a little bit like trying to pick one conversation in a crowded room. There's quite a bit of background noise going on. But no doubt there is some effect occurring of the European slowdown on Asia. I would say, though, that most of the high-frequency data that we look at for the region around the turn of the year, just going into 2012, do not seem to show an intensification of the slowing that we saw last year. It's probably too early, I think, to claim that there's a new pickup underway, but we don't, I think, see signs of the rapid fall in trade that we saw at the end of 2008. Speaking of 2008, that of course brings me to the third potential channel through which events in Europe could have, and still maybe could, affect all of us, and that's the financial one. The financial channel is easily the most unpredictable and potentially most damaging. And here I'm not thinking so much of direct exposures of our institutions to the troubled European countries, though there'll be a little bit of that in Australia's case. Those are very, very small. But it's more the general impact, the financial turmoil on global markets and therefore on all our institutions. If you think back to 2008 in the couple of months following the Lehman failure, what we saw was effectively a closure of funding markets for financial institutions. We saw credit conditions tighten. We saw trade finance drop off. We saw share prices go down very quickly. We saw household and business confidence abate very quickly, more or less everywhere in the world at the same time. There was a moment late in 2011, I think, when people began to fear that something like that might recur on this occasion. Funding markets certainly tightened up. For European banks, they more or less closed. Interbank activity more or less ceased in Europe. The cocktail of sovereign credit issues, exposures of European banks to those sovereigns, potential capital shortfalls in European banks, a looming large refinancing task in the early months of this year, not to mention the dynamics of the Greek workout, were all things which had very much on everybody very much on edge. And those effects were felt right around the world. I think it's obvious that the actions of the ECB in recent months have been quite transformative in addressing that situation. Tensions have eased greatly. Many markets have reopened, albeit at continually a fairly high cost. Sovereign spreads for countries like Italy or Spain have come down quite a lot. There's been a recovery in equity prices and so on. So that's all good. It's very good because a potentially very nasty situation was averted. But a lot more needs to be done yet to put European sovereigns and banks onto a sound footing for the long run. Interbank activity remains constrained. Unsecured funding remains very difficult and very expensive for European banks. In fact, it's noteworthy, it seems to me, at present that many industrial corporates can borrow more cheaply than the banks that used to lend to them, even though the banks have ostensibly a higher credit rating, such is the odium that investors have for banks globally, relatively speaking, at the moment. So a lot more needs to be done in the financial area, but a lot also needs to be done in Europe on the supply side to get growth. Because the truth is, if you don't have the growth, then the fiscal arithmetic will always be challenging at best and maybe impossible at worst. So there's a lot more to do there, and that's why, as I say, I think that the progress towards sustainability on these multiple fronts is likely to be a long road. And on that road, we will have numerous periods of anxiety over the months and years ahead. Well, meanwhile, while everybody's been fixated on Europe, the US economy, as we see it anyway, has been going better. It didn't lapse into a double-dip recession. It's in fact continued to grind out a modest expansion. In recent times, the pace of employment growth has picked up, and some other labour market indicators are showing some signs of improvement. So one of the headwinds that had been facing the US seems to just be lessening a bit. It's not the only headwind, there are others, but this is actually moderately good news, I think. Of course, the US has its own challenges to face, not least the need for its own fiscal consolidation at some point, which could damage growth as that's done. Personally, I remain a relative optimist on the US in the long run because I think its inherent dynamism and capacity to innovate is matched by few other societies. And I think, therefore, that's a reason for long-run optimism. And then we come to China. Well, the Chinese slowdown from 10% growth to a mere 8% has had everybody talking. And some see it as portending a major slump in Chinese growth. Some slowing, though, surely was required if the Chinese authorities were to get on top of the inflation problems they had and various other excesses that we're all familiar with, in order to put growth onto a more sustainable path. I think one can certainly think of ways in which China could have a hard landing. But, you know, it's very difficult to know for sure, I think, and I suspect even more difficult sitting in a trading room in London or New York or, for that matter, in Sydney. But if the Chinese economy does slow too much, then I think it's reasonable to expect that the Chinese authorities would have both the will and the means to respond to that. The thing to remember is China will have cycles, like everybody else. All economies have cycles, and we need to recognise that. But it still seems to me quite likely that the Chinese economy will grow pretty strongly, on average, for quite a while yet. It will ultimately turn out to be a very large economy. Even at the new lower growth target, which was announced recently, bearing in mind that I think for the preceding 7 years the growth targets were always exceeded, but even at the new lower target, China's real GDP, measured in purchasing power parity terms, will probably get to be about the same as the United States within a decade or a little more, and it will exceed the euro area sooner than that. So China's going to be a very, very large economy. So prospects for China are as difficult to fathom and as imponderable as they sometimes might seem, will be critical for all of us. There are some issues surrounding rebalancing of growth in Asia, and I want to come back to that just as I finish, but the main point for now, I think, is that the global economy, yes, faces a year of subtrend growth this year, according to international forecasts. That's a subdued outcome, though not a disastrous one. It's certainly true that it's easier to think of downside risks to that than upside ones. But at this stage, in my view anyway, the downside risks remain risks rather than actual outcomes. What then about Australia? Let me turn to make a few remarks there. And the thing that I find striking as I travel around to other countries is the way the viewpoints of those outside Australia differ from those of us inside the country. And in brief, the people outside tend to have a more optimistic view of our country than many of us who are there working away on a daily basis. Viewed from abroad, judging by what people say, observers see an economy that experienced only a relatively mild downturn at the end of 2008 or early 2009 that made up the decline in output quite quickly within a matter of months, and which has continued to expand, albeit at only a moderate pace since then. They see an economy that has not experienced a serious recession for about 20 years now, that has strong banks, little government debt, and what debt there is AAA rated. Some observers, it's true, worry about housing debt, and that's not surprising given that housing debt's gone up a lot over the past couple of decades and given what's happened in some other countries. But then other people point out that the arrears rates on mortgages, which are at about 60 basis points, that's quite low by virtually any standard. And it's not as though we've had an excessive building of housing, and if anything, we haven't been building enough for population needs over recent years. Foreign investors see a country that remains open largely to them, and that, reflecting its circumstances, offers higher rates of return on capital than many other jurisdictions, even though those interest rates, by our historical standards, are in fact a bit on the low side. People outside the country understand the potential gains from the mineral and energy wealth that's stored in or around our landmass, and they understand that our terms of trade are the highest for more than a century. And that's seen increased appetite for Australian dollar denominated assets, particularly sovereign debt, and it's helped to push up the Australian dollar over recent years. Well, the people at home see all that too. They get the story of the resource boom. They get the terms of trade story. They see the effect of the high exchange rate, and indeed have been getting on planes and travelling abroad in record numbers over the past year or two. However, as producers, people at home also see, I think with increasing clarity, that the rise in the relative price of natural resources and energy relative to prices of manufactures and services, or at least some services, is a very large historical, epochal even, event, which carries important implications for economic structure in our country, indeed as it does everywhere else. Some sectors of the economy will grow in importance in response to this relative price change. Others will, relatively speaking, get smaller as they face lower prices for their products and increased competition for productive inputs, labour and capital, from the sectors which are stronger. Clearly, the exchange rate being as high as it is sending a very strong signal to the productive sector to change the mix of industries that we have, though I think the fact is that this would occur at any exchange rate, because the fundamental shift in relative prices is not something that we have created. It's not something that's a function of the Australian dollar. It's a global relative price change. In other words, while the global shift in relative prices is income enhancing for Australia in a major way, it's also structural change inducing. We had a former Prime Minister who once quipped that the topic of microeconomic reform, which is the way we describe structural reform, was such a common topic that even the parrots in the pet shop were talking about it. I think that over the years ahead, we at home will all be talking about structural adaptation in very much the same way. And structural adaptation, of course, is hard work. Not many of us volunteer for it because it's difficult. We have little choice but to do it if we are not only to make the most of the opportunities we face, but simply to respond to the changed circumstances that many industries are now facing. In this sense, Australia, though blessed with many natural endowments, is in the same position as any other country. We have to adapt to changing circumstances. And I think it is the fact that we face that need to adapt that helps to explain, at least in part, a certain sense of apprehension and discomfort that if you travel to Australia, you will probably notice. We're tending a little at the moment to focus on the challenges that come from our situation more so than the opportunities, even though the opportunities are no smaller than they seemed a year or two ago. So this difference in perceptions between how we're feeling at home and how we seem to be viewed from outside, it's unusual. For most of my career, we tended to struggle to convince foreign investors and international organisations that the economic performance we were turning in was not too bad. It's only a little more than a decade ago that Australia was written off as an old economy, too reliant on natural resources, not doing enough in producing IT goods and so on. So things have changed, at least relatively speaking. This, I think, is part of a larger global shift that's going on. And there's a shift in global portfolios, it seems to me, which is occurring, though it's hard to document this. In a more risk-averse world, the availability of genuinely low-risk financial assets seems to be considerably smaller than it looked 10 years ago. Countries that have offered a reasonably stable economic environment, sensible policies, relatively sound public finances, and Australia is one of those, though not the only one. There's a number of other jurisdictions one could list. But these countries are attracting now, I think, materially more official capital flow than we might have some time in the past. That's recently been adding to the upward pressure on the exchange rate, independently of the terms of trade fundamentals that we've spoken about so much in the past. Well, as is so often the case in economics, there are two sides to that. A higher exchange rate, other things equal, hurts competitiveness, so it's a contractionary force on our economy. On the other hand, a cheaper supply of capital from the rest of the world is expansionary. Capital's cheaper for borrowers, especially government borrowers, and even for the private sector. The low level of official yields helps at least to offset some of the rise in spreads due to perceptions of credit risk, which has occurred. Well, the greater flow of cheap capital is very much an advantage. Of course, it's important that you use it well, and there have been occasions in the past where countries had a flow of capital looking for very safe assets that got turned into risky assets, the US subprime story being the most prominent case in point. At this stage, we don't seem to have that problem in Australia. If anything, most governments, many households, many businesses are intent on getting their debt down rather than up. The financial sector is quite risk-averse in its lending practices, particularly to the few business sectors that would be prepared to take on some more debt if they could. So, at this point, it might be argued that at the margin, the contractionary effect of the high exchange rate might just be, for a certain period of time, a little greater than the expansionary effect of the fact that the cost of capital is going down. Whether that will persist, of course, remains to be seen. The economic backdrop to this set of forces, which are very large and without many precedents in our history, the backdrop is an economy where a range of indicators for most of last year suggested growth near trend. Most of the business surveys suggested that. The unemployment rate, reasonably low by our standards and not changing very much. The recent GDP data do suggest the non-farm economy growing a little bit lower than trend. So there's a slightly mixed picture. Overall, I think one could characterise our economic performance as not too bad, particularly given in a comparison over a run of years with a number of other advanced economies. But while it's not too bad, neither is it so good that it couldn't be improved. And that's actually what, in Australia, we should be turning our minds to. Obviously, the full range of policies, macroeconomic and structural policies, need to play their role in getting any improvement in performance we can. Monetary policy can play a role in supporting demand to the extent allowed by the inflation target and likely future inflation performance, and that's what we focus on each month. But monetary policy can't raise the trend growth rate of the economy. That lies in the realm of productivity enhancing behaviour at the firm level, at the government level, and indeed at the intergovernment level in our country. Improving productivity growth, in fact, is the only way of sustaining growth in living standards once the terms of trade gain has been absorbed. That is increasingly recognised in our public debate. Of course, it's important that we do more than just debate it. Nor can monetary policy obviate the pressure for the economy's structure to change in response to the shift in relative prices. Those relative prices are given to us by the world economy, not by any policy that we adopt. And there's no way that there's a policy in Australia that makes that go away. So in our case, reorienting our economy in some respects, both to take advantage of the opportunities and to respond to the change circumstances that many other industries face, that is our challenge, and we have to face that, I think, in essence, by looking to improving our productivity performance if we possibly can. But we're hardly alone in facing the need for structural change. And here I want to come back to the Asian region. I think reorienting economies in this region and indeed elsewhere in the world remains a major challenge for all of us. Changes in the right direction certainly have been occurring. Countries in this region have increasingly over the past decade, I think, adopted policy frameworks which guide domestic policies in a sensible way. And here I think of a number of countries taking up inflation targeting, which I think obviously is a very sensible approach. Countries in the region have been prepared to allow a little bit more movement in their exchange rates. They've been prepared to seek more in the way of domestically led growth in demand than perhaps in the past. It's worth noting in that context, by the way, that in the case of China in particular, the ratio of domestic demand to GDP has been rising in recent years, offsetting more or less a fall that had occurred a few years before that. So they're all good adjustments. My view is that more of that, a good deal more of that, will be required in the future for at least three reasons. Firstly, it is not a sustainable model to expect developed world households to buy ever-increasing quantities of the output of Asian factories with borrowed money. That model is broken, it can't come back, and I think that means that from that point of view, the imperative to seek more domestic sources of demand growth is not just cyclical, it is going to be a persistent challenge. Secondly, the eventual sheer size of the Asian economy, taking not just China but the whole of Asia together, that economy will be so large that there just won't be any other option but for that economy to absorb more and more of its own output over time. Continental-sized economies, like the US or even the Euro area, absorb most of their production. And Asia will, I think, need to be the same as it gets bigger. It's important to note in that context that outside of China and Japan, as I read it, the decline in domestic demand, largely due to falling investment that we saw in the Asian crisis, much of that decline actually remains in place today. That's something that I think will need to change over time. And then thirdly, and maybe most importantly, it will surely be the most enriching strategy for the citizens of Asia to turn more of their own savings to upgrading their physical and human capital here in this region. But at present, trillions of dollars of the money of the citizens of Asia is lent to highly indebted Western governments at yields which seem remarkably low. It seems to me very unlikely that there would not be better risk-adjusted returns than that on offer in Asia itself or in some of the other emerging market areas. Well, time for me to finish. I suppose my theme is that there are a number of challenges that face all of us and a number of opportunities that we all have to adapt towards and to grab hold of. I think it will be a fascinating journey for the region. I think it might well be a turbulent one from time to time, but it will be rewarding nonetheless. In Australia, we will be facing our own structural adaptation issues, but we will also be taking much more than a casual interest in developments in this region in this Asian century. Thank you very much.
Are there any questions at all for Governor Stevens? One at the back, thank you.
Thank you. It's Eric Chow from Value Partners. Governor Stevens, good to see you here. As you may know, there are many Australians living in Hong Kong, so we are glad to see you here. My questions are about the banking system of our country. As you know, Australia actually heavily relies on foreign capital. With our loan-to-deposit ratio well over 100%, then do you think that is a significant risk factor going forward? If so, then is there any solution to that? Then next question, my final one, is that in case of a, let's say, worst-case scenario, there is a bank going under in Australia, then will RBA give up the four-pillar strategy to allow some of them to merge in order to rescue a bank? Thank you.
Well, I can tackle the second one first. The four pillars policy is not my policy. I have no say in how many pillars we have. That's a matter for the minister, and I'm happy to leave it very much in his court. I see no early sign of an intention to alter that policy. On the bank funding, it's true, as you say, that certainly for many years the significant Australian banks raised a good deal of money offshore. They still do, and they've been getting pretty reasonable access, I think, to those markets, albeit at higher spreads over the past 6 months or so. They have, though, lessened that reliance notably, not completely, but a good deal more of the funding that they have is now coming from the local deposit market, and it's actually quite interesting the extent of competition to raise deposits that we see. Some years ago there was a lot of competition to lend money when it was easy to raise and cheap to raise. Now there's a lot more competition to raise money among the financial institutions, which is good for savers. And I think that's all part of the adjustment of the balance sheets progressively away from quite so much reliance on wholesale, particularly offshore wholesale funding, and more towards normal retail and wholesale deposit money onshore. So that adjustment's ongoing, probably hasn't finished yet, but they've made some progress there.
Is there a question at the back?
Tony Boyd from the Australian Financial Review. The speech you've just given seems to be suggesting that foreign investors are going to continue to back Australia, and I suppose conferences like this will remind people of how much return on equity, they can, return on capital they can get. I just wonder, are you really saying that the pain before we get the gain will be quite prolonged because this capital flow will keep the dollar elevated at levels which are much higher than this has been historically?
Well, I'm just trying, Tony, to present a balanced picture of the issues that we face. I think it's a little bit trite, isn't it, to talk about the pain being prolonged before the gain. There's already been a tremendous surge in income in the country, and there will be a fair bit more of that coming because the build-up in resource sector investment has quite a way to go yet. But the main point is there's been a very large change in global relative prices, and that will occasion structural adjustment in any economy, including ours. And I think we're increasingly understanding that, and I think it's the job of people like me to try to explain that story, as complex as it is.
A question in the middle, please.
Just a quick question. It's Peter Kwan from Alpha Group Holdings. With the China economy slowing down, how do you see the Australian to US dollar? How much of an impact do you believe that the FX Australian US dollar will correct, if any? And if, you know, if particularly if the Australian interest rate is to reduce? Thank you.
Well, there are two rules of forecasting. First rule is don't. Second rule is if you do forecast, never forecast exchange rates, because that is easily, without question, the most poorly forecast variable in economics. There's plenty of literature to show that. So I don't know what will happen to the currency. Presumably, a certain degree of expected slowing in China and so on is already reflected in that price, but so market participants will, as always, await new data and see whether it's as they expect or not, and react accordingly. But I don't really have for you any particular forecast on that particular bilateral rate. A lot would depend on what happens to the US dollar itself, of course, which would be a function of, among other things, how the US economy itself is travelling. So there's too many variables really at work there to make a confident prediction, I think.
Thanks. Matt Wolf from Capital World Investors. Could you talk a little bit about the change that's happened? Traditionally, when the RBA adjusted the cash rate, the standard variable rates of the banks would adjust by a similar amount, and it looks like that tradition is changing a little bit. How does that change the way you think about setting the RBA's cash rate? Thank you.
Well, it's interesting to hear it described as a tradition, because really the period of time where the lockstep movement happened, it did happen for a decade or so in a uniquely stable financial environment where risk spreads and so on were very low and barely ever moved. And so it kind of built up this apparent relationship between the RBA rate and other rates. But if you go back into history, actually that was not necessarily the norm in earlier periods. And as we've seen over recent years, the shifting of risk spreads is a factor that has become something of a wedge between the rate we set and the set of interest rates that really affect the economy. But as I've said many times, we've taken account of that in the way we set the overnight rate, and it's probably at least 100 points lower today than it would have been without that margin widening. So roughly speaking, not precisely, but to a large extent, we have taken account of that. It's been said recently at home that this somehow makes monetary policy ineffective. I don't really think that's true. I think, you know, if we make material changes to the overnight rate, that will still have quite a big impact on the structure of rates out for the first year or two of the curve, and that will deliver the effect we need. So it doesn't concern me greatly, but it's just an additional complication that we have, and it's certainly an additional complication from an explanation point of view, as you will have seen if you observe the debate at home.
Joshua Crabb, BlackRock. I guess the question I have for you is, we've talked a lot about some of the structural changes required in Asia. What would be some of the, I guess, advice you would give to the policymakers? The one we hear most is currency, but what else do you think can be done?
Well, I don't give gratuitous advice to other policymakers, certainly not in public, or for that matter in private. But I think, in all honesty, I think the points that I'm trying to articulate of, you know, more searches, searching for more domestically led growth, allowing markets to do some of their work, I think the policymakers in the region do get that. And really for them it's a matter of charting the path to the long run future, and I think they're pretty well equipped to do it. So I wouldn't, you know, seek to preach at them really here today, I don't think. I don't think it'd be helpful any way to do so.
Hi, you talked a little bit about inflation, or you didn't really mention inflation. Can you be kind enough to paint us a balanced picture of the inflationary situation in Australia right now? Thank you.
Well, the last forecast that we published, which was early February, so not that long ago, suggested that the inflation rate would be broadly consistent with the target, 2 to 3% over the next couple of years, which is probably as long a period as we can sensibly make that forecast. Since then, we've had some data, some of which is a little mixed, so we'll be working through the implications of that, and we'll get another update on the price outlook during April. But for today, I think I would just stick with the forecast in the February statement that we issued. So it looks to us, on what we can see at the moment, that things will be between 2 and 3% over the next couple of years.
On that note,
very good to finish on target, David.
It is. Target of inflation and target of time. Glenn, thank you very, very much for joining us today. And everyone, if you could join me.
Thank you.